Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas, brought to you by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to some of today's most complicated issues. Today's guest is Abbas Molani. Abbas is a research fellow and co-director of the Iran Democracy Project at the Hoover Institution and the Hamid and Christina Mogadam, director of Iranian studies at Stanford University. Before coming to Stanford, Molani was a professor of history and political science, chair of the department at Notre Dame de Damour University, in addition to being an assistant professor in the Faculty of Law and Political Science at Tehran University in Iran. He was born in Iran, came to California when he was 16 years old, and was educated at UC Berkeley and got a PhD from University of Hawaii. He's published many books, including The Myth of the Great Satan, A New Look at America's Relations with Iran, and The Shah. We have a conversation today about Iran and the Middle East. Thanks for joining. Welcome, Abbas Molani. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
A lot happening in Iran, and you are the Iran expert in my mind, and I think I'd like to start by making the audience aware of your sort of very unique background. You were born in Iran, and you came to the U.S. and California for your higher education, including a PhD. And then you went back to Iran and served in the university there. This is back in the 70s. And from your bio, I see you were in jail as a political prisoner there. So let's start with that, and maybe you could relate your story for us.
Well, a part of coming to California in the 60s and 70s was to get radicalized. That was almost the rigor at Berkeley. So I'd gone back radicalized, and I began teaching, as you said, but after about a year and a half, I was arrested and spent a year in prison under the Shah. And what made that experience, in a way, singular, for me for sure, was that 6 months of it, I spent in the same cell block with the people who would become future leaders of the Islamic Republic, Mr. Montazeri, Rafsanjani, Taleghani, almost everybody, with the exception of Khomeini, who was out of the country. And so I got a sense of the kind of people these are long before they became the rulers of Iran.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the demographics of Iran. Okay, that, you know, there are ethnic groups, there are religious groups, sort of where we are now, because I think it's very confusing to people like me who are not experts on the region.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the misconceptions people have of Iran. Iran is a very complicated society. I would say the most important misconception is a belief that Iran is a profoundly religious society. Iran was never that religious, and today I think it's really the most secular society in the Middle East. We can talk about this later, but Iran has multiplicities of religion. Iran is believed to be the Shiite state, but at least about a quarter of the population are Sunnis. There are at least still living in Iran, 25,000 Iranian Jews. Jews have lived in Iran for 3,000 years, literally 3,000 years of continuous living. Before the revolution, Iran had anywhere between 100 to 150,000 Jewish Iranians. That era, the Pahlavi era, from 1925 to 79, is accepted by the top Israeli scholars on Iran. For example, David Menasheri, who has written a book about Iranian Jews. He says that 50 year was the golden era for Iranian Jews. Iran also has at least several hundred thousand members of the Baha'i faith, which is a religion that grew out of Iran in 19th century. They live under extreme persecution. Iran has many other religious minorities, Armenians, Christians, Christian converts. this regime has created the largest conversion to Christianity in Iran's history. There's never been as many conversions to Christianity as under this regime.
Since this regime took over, you're saying?
Absolutely.
In 1979 or whatever.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Let me ask a related question, which I think, as a Westerner, I don't understand. What about the history or the even today Islam? We see the terms radical Islam, radical fundamentalist Islam, always joined in the news, usually. And then in other places we see, you know, Islam or moderate. Is there a bulk of people who are moderate Islamists, or is part of Islam jihad, overthrow or death to people who are, quote, non-believers? Can you clarify what that is?
Yes, I think that's a very brilliant question, I think. People have written about this, not just about Iran, but just about Islamic societies
right.
in general. And that's the difference between Islamic and Islamist. Clifford Geertz has written about this, for example. If you're an Islamist, which is you want to enforce Sharia, then you are by definition a radical. Then you're by definition a despot, because democracy is based on ambiguity. Democracy is based on pluralism. And if you believe that your God is the greatest, and Allahu Akbar incidentally doesn't mean God is great, it means God is greatest. If you believe your God is the greatest and everybody else is confused, if not heretical, then you can't but be a jihadist. But if you believe Islam is your faith, and you allow other people to live, and you're an Islamic person, not an Islamist. You don't want to force your ideas on me, you know? My mother sometimes wore the hijab, sometimes didn't. Didn't force her views on anybody else. But if she had become an Islamist, she would say, my daughter has to wear this. So an Islamist is by definition, in my view, becomes both despotic and in a sense, combative, in a sense, jihadist, as you say. Khamenei, who just died, who takes his cues intellectually, theologically, from one of the most important Sunni theologians, Sayyid Ghaut of the Muslim Brotherhood. He translated three of his books. Basically, he says, if you accept Islam, it's incumbent on your acceptance of Islam to engage in jihad. I'm verbatim quoting him.
And does that mean death to non-believers?
It certainly means death to non-believers. And it means second-class citizenship for Jews and Christians and Zoroastrians who are considered in both in Islamic theology as people of the book. People of the book are people who are from one of the religions that historically have a sacred book that they believe is given by Allah. Initially, only Christians and Jews were protected. When Islam conquered Iran and they realized there are millions of Zoroastrians, for taxing issues, they also included Zoroastrians in the people of the book. So these are protected religions. And historically, for example, if you look at the medieval times, Jews lived more safely in the Islamic world under the protectorate than they lived in many parts of Europe. But today, ever since we accept religion as a matter of private domain, their status is second-class citizenship in Iran.
Okay, but does second-class citizenship equate with death? In other words, let me ask this two ways. Number one, in Iran today, are Jewish people a protected class, or are they subject to death, or are they just second-class citizens? That's question number one. And question number two is what the Islamist that you describe, is that the majority of people in Iran today?
The answer to the second question is emphatically no.
Emphatically no.
No. That's the problem this regime has. This regime is an Islamist regime, and the great majority of the Iranian people. We have some actually empirical data. We have a fairly reliable poll that says 88% of the people don't want the status quo. Something like 65% want a very clear distinction between state and religion. And that's not an Islamist view. But the regime is an Islamist. And one reason the regime is doomed to fail is because it is absolutely incommensurate with the desires and sentiments of the majority of the people, the great, great majority of the people. And Jews are considered the people of the book, as are Christians, as are Zoroastrians. They're not subjected to death. But for an Islamist, if you are none of these three groups, then your blood is free to be taken. You are makdur al-dam, literally.
Why? What happened? Let me go back and ask about the Iranian Revolution in 1979, which was protests against the Shah, and ultimately led to Khomeini's return. Why was that successful if there was such religious sort of heterogeneity that you describe of the era and the sort of golden age of Iranian Jewish people or other people that were not these Islamists? I mean, why was that overthrow or takeover successful? How did that happen?
Well, again, that's one of those very fascinating questions. Iran had, in 1975, for example, 4 years before the revolution, one of the most roaring economies in the developing world. Iran had at times 20% GDP growth. A large number of people have been lifted into middle class. Education was free for Iran. Iran was actually hiring engineers and workers from everywhere, from South Korea to Philippines to the US. They would come into the US and hire engineers, Iranian as well as others. So it is a very difficult thing to understand why did this country go through this convulsion. It's a very large number of factors. One is that after 75, the price of oil stabilized much more than the Shah had anticipated. So the economy went from a roaring period to a slowdown. Two, the Shah discovered that he had cancer and was under chemotherapy. Three, Jimmy Carter comes and becomes a president and forces the Shah to liberalize human rights. And then he becomes preoccupied with Camp David and really loses sight of what is happening in Iran. Because once Carter comes and once this economic slowdown happens, the opposition basically thinks that the Shah is weak. They didn't know about his sickness, but they thought the West is no longer supporting him. And they took to the streets and demanding not a theocracy, but demanding more democracy.
But that was because of the Shah being more autocratic or corrupt or both?
Partially both. But the sense of the, for example, authoritarianism was far greater than in fact was. To give you an example, we in the opposition used to say, at least for myself, I can speak for myself to my shame, used to say there are 100,000 political prisoners in Iran. The actual number was 3,500.
You're talking about in the 70s?
In the 70s. 76, when Carter came, human rights groups came to prison, and I talked to one of them. I talked to some Amnesty. I said, you've been to all prisoners. How many political prisoners are others? And they said, it says 3,500. We used to say tens of thousands of Iranians have been executed. Well, the actual number for the entire 37 year of the Shah was less than 1,500. So these exaggerations existed, but there was this sense of authoritarianism. But there was also, I think, something that people now realize, and I wish they had realized then, and that was that people equated authoritarianism with the ability to criticize the Shah. If you're going to criticize the Shah, the system was authoritarian. There was criticism of the Shah that was banned, but there was cultural pluralism in Iran at that time. There was religious pluralism. Mm-hmm. There was pluralism for women. Women's rights were unequaled in Iran compared to other countries. There was enormous innovation in the arts. You just couldn't directly call the Shah a lapdog of U.S. imperialism. Okay. And the opposition said, we can't say this, so there is political oppression. But you could make almost any play. Iran had this Shiraz festival. They brought some of the most innovative, modernist, radical artists for several years. Hmm. Nobody paid attention to those. Women could do anything they want. In 1975, there was a gay marriage in Tehran, a public gay marriage in Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of that cultural diversity was overshadowed by the fact that you can't criticize the Shah, and they're political prisoners. You know, they were political prisoners. But this regime, the reason people have nostalgia for the Pahlavi era, this regime has killed, in about 2 months ago, in January, according to its own numbers, 3,177 people. The real number, the President Trump says, is 30,000.
31,000?
31,000. No, the regime says 3,100.
I see.
The real number is, I think, closer to 30. That's in 3 days more than the Shah did in 37 years.
Mm-hmm. How was it that the, what was the, we hear all the time in the Khomeini regime, the U.S. is referred to as the Great Satan. Okay, what is the sort of basis for that? Is it this colonial influence over the Shah, with the Shah or over the Shah, or is it simply a decadent society? Or is it non-believers in Islamism or something else?
It's a combination of some of these. Again, that's a very important question. And it shows how cleverly and duplicitously Khomeini made his discourse. He always, when he attacked America, he attacked it in a way as if this was a fight against imperialism. But he used the anti-colonial rhetoric.
Argument,
and
right.
In that way, he sort of fooled a lot of the left, Iranian left and international leftists, to think of him as this figure of national liberation. He was actually both a xenophobe and anti-modern. The battle was against America stood for secularism. America stood for democracy. America stood for humanism. And these things, America stood for an alliance with Israel. And Khomeini was profoundly, in my view, both anti-Israeli and anti-Semitic. But he always couched it in the rhetoric of anti-Zionism. And that, I think, was one of the sources of his rhetoric. And Khomeini picked up where Khomeini had started and developed this into even a more elaborate theory, that the U.S. is engaged in a culture war. I wrote a piece for the Caravan, Hoover's Caravan. It's called Khomeini, Don Quixote, and His Culture Wars. And you read it, you read his writing. It's for 35 years he's preoccupied that the West, beguiled by Israel, is engaging in this war with Islam, the war of modernity, which is secularism. Secularism for him, literally for, say, Khomeini. And Khomeini is a Jewish-Christian trick to create the nation of the notion of nation and replace it with the notion of ummah, spiritual community. Islamists don't believe in nationalism. They believe in spiritual community, in ummah. Islamic, in Iran, you can be a Muslim and a patriot, but you can't be an Islamist and a patriot.
And so in the region, outside of Iran, do Islamists share the same sort of belief? And what I always wondered, okay, with a war or a conflict like we've seen in Iran, I think many of us over the decades have been under the idea that the other countries would ally with Iran. And I think everything has changed, and we'll talk about that a little bit with the economic relationships, et cetera. But the Islamists in these other countries, I mean, Iran is not the only Islamist focus in the region, is it? I mean, what is going on with the other people, since they don't believe in national, you're saying that the national sort of identity is not really relevant to most of the people that are Islamist. It's simply Islamist. Islamism.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Is this true everywhere, including people who are, for instance, immigrants to the United States?
I think the majority of every poll I have seen, the majority of the Muslims who come to the United States are not Islamists. They're Islamic. Although there are pockets of them who try to create Sharia, who try to force their rules on neighborhoods when they become dominant in the neighborhood. But the majority, every poll I have seen, the majority doesn't believe that. And the majority of the Muslims and the rest of the, but Islamists.
Including in the UK, does that same sort of characterization?
I don't know the data on the UK.
Okay.
I don't know the data on the UK. But, you know, where they get most of their Muslims is very different than where the U.S. has gotten most of the Muslims. But so I can't speak knowledgeably about what the U.K. does, what the Muslims in the U.K. do. You know, 1979 is a very important period for the rise of Islamist movements in the region. In other words, Khomeini's victory in Iran again, for some of the audience, in case they don't know this, Iran, as you said, this is predominantly Shiite country. The rest of the Middle East is predominantly Sunni. 80% of Muslims of the world are Sunnis, and 20%, 25 max, are Shiites. And of those Shiites, a very small minority believe in Khomeini and Khomeini's version of Shiism, which says Islamist, we rule, the mullah should rule. But there is a convergence of animosities, convergence of enemies between Sunni and Shiite radicals. When ISIS came to power, one of the first symbolic things they did, they went to the border. If you remember, they had the territory, Syria and Iraq, I think. They came to that border and tore their passports and said, this is a sign of colonialism. We don't accept these borders and we don't accept these passports. We are an ummah.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the evolution of terrorism. I mean, since the... certainly since this Iranian regime that was just sort of being partially deposed, I guess, the Khomeini regime, mm-hmm. It's been called, and it has been, I think, the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. And there's been, you know, thousands of people killed by them, both inside their own country as well as outside with terrorism, including the U.S. and U.S. bases and things. And we know this history. First of all, we hear a lot about this terroristic sort of regime, partly that they fund their proxies to get some of this terrorism done, right? Hezbollah, for instance. Is Iran the only country in the Middle East that is funding these sorts of proxies and proxy activities of terrorism? Or are they just the number one and there are others?
I think there are others. There are credible reports that, for example, the Arab states and the Persian Gulf helped some of the radical Sunnis before. There's some reporting that some of the rich Arabs, for example, supported ISIS in its earliest stages because they thought they need a kind of a terrorist organization to combat the Iranian terrorist organization of Shiites. Lebanon in Hezbollah, Saudi Arabia realized they need something that can fight the Hezbollah. So they have done this, but I think clearly to me, the Iranian regime is the number one supporter in terms of the number of places they have engaged in terrorist activities, the number of people they have killed. Sure. Iranians inside Iran, Iranians outside Iran, Americans in Lebanon, Americans in Iraq, Jews everywhere they could find their hands on.
If that funding of these proxies, you know, Iran was has a lot of, I mean, over the years, a lot of money from, you know, obviously oil revenue. They were given a lot of money during the Obama era of so-called negotiated peace, and I think that there's been a lot done in the last days that have really stopped this sort of money flow to Iran in their oil revenues, et cetera. And so the question to me is, maybe this is just a theoretical question, but will there be others? What will happen to these terrorist sort of proxies, which are, I'm not sure how well structured they are. I'm not sure how informal versus formal versus just isolated people or so-called sleeper cells, this kind of thing. If the Iran support of these things dries up in a good outcome sort of way, will others fill that void? I mean, what do you think will be on the landscape then?
I can't imagine, I can't predict the future, but I don't think there will be a force as rich in possibilities in terms of oil revenues. Khamenei, according to a very well-researched report by Reuters a few years ago, controlled singularly over $100 billion in assets. He wasn't personally corrupt, but he was politically corrupt in a sense that he used that money any which way he wanted. How much of that money was, for example, being used to fund Hezbollah? How much of it was used to fund Hamas? We don't know. Several years ago, I wrote an article which is available for free online about Khamenei's creation of this university called Jamiatul Mustafa. At one time, they had students from 90 countries, full-funded scholarship students. It was modeled on the Patrice Lumumba University in the Soviet Union, where they would bring in students, teach them some theology, make some of them propagandists, some of them agents. Remarkable budget, and it doesn't appear anywhere in the government budget. And much of this money that they spend on these terror organizations is managed the same way. It is a very difficult labyrinth of finances that they have to support this, the proxies that they have. And proxies, incidentally, isn't just kinetic proxies. They have intellectual proxies. They have people that they support, the foundations, publishing houses around the world that propagates their ideas.
Talk about the impact of the Obama era on the Iranian regime and on the Iranian nuclear ambitions with this. It was really twofold. One was stopping the sanctions or the severe sanctions, but also delivering significant money directly to the regime with this. I'm going to say everything was well intended, but what was the impact of that kind of policy in that era, in your view?
The nuclear deal that the Obama administration signed, the JCPOA, was, in my view, a flawed but the best deal at that time. I think the alternative would have been war, maybe, because I think the Israelis were very worried about Iran's development of a nuclear weapon. I was a critic of it because I said then, I wrote it then, that they should have included Iran's proxies, they should have included Iran's nuclear missile program, and they should have included Iran's human rights issues. None of those were. As Obama has himself said, he got some bad advice from some of these proxies of Iran that if you raise these other issues, Khamenei will walk away from a deal. And Obama wanted to make that deal. And as part of the deal, they put some cash on the plane and send it to Iran. And Iran used that very much, very effectively to their benefit. They said, we got $1.6 billion cash. We forced it on them, and they turned it into a great victory. The other remarkable thing is that the sanctions that you're talking about, we have a group of our scholars at Iranian Studies. They're about to publish an essay. I've seen a draft of it. Iran has been selling oil illegally almost the entire the Biden era. They've been selling almost $60 billion a year.
Even and with everyone, sanctions in place, you're saying?
Even with sanctions in place.
Why do they want to, but how do they get away with that? Is it because their customers are people who don't care about, are not allies of the United States? For instance, Asia or whatever?
China is the main purchaser of it. India was the second. China buys it at a 50 to 60% discount. China keeps all the money. One third of it is an escrow account that the Iranian government spends. One third of it they keep. And one third of it, they decide the kind of commodities they sell to Iran. It's a very sweet deal for China to buy oil at discount. India buying oil at great discount.
But that's only part of it, really. I mean, isn't it also an indication of the lack of teeth of those sanctions? In other words, we say there are sanctions, but we don't enforce them?
I think their research indicates is that the Biden administration essentially decided to look the other way and gave them a hint that we were going to look the other way in the hope that the Iranians would work with them in limiting their nuclear program. It was a false assumption. I think the person in charge of Iran desk at the time, Mr. Robert Mali, believed that if you make these concessions, Iran will behave. But Iran has shown 30 years that the more concessions you make, the more they will out-cheat you, and the more they will establish their program. When the West began to make these concessions on the nuclear, Iran had a few hundred centrifuges. By the time the Obama administration came, there were, I think, 12,000 centrifuges. By the time the attacks came in the 12-day war, Iran had 18,000 very active, very developed centrifuges. Almost all of that is gone.
Almost all of that is gone.
Iran's capacity for enrichment is virtually all done.
This is something I wanted to ask you, is how confident should we be watching the news in the effectiveness of the destruction of the so-called Iran nuclear program? And where does it stand right now?
I think I'm not a nuclear scientist, but I wrote an article with Sig Hacker, who was head of Los Alamos for many years, I think one of America's top nuclear scientists. We had written a couple of pieces, one on Iran's enrichment program 12 years ago, where we said, give up enrichment, because there's no way you can convince the world that you don't have a bomb attempt. And they didn't listen to it. And we wrote another one after the 12-day war. We said, and Sig Hacker, Professor Hacker, could say this much, much more credibly than I could, because he knows the science. He said, virtually you have no capacity for enrichment. What you have left is a little more than 400 kilos of 60% enriched uranium. You can at best make a dirty bomb with that. Give up this stuff. Accept that you will give up enrichment and make peace with the world. I mean, if they really wanted to have reason, they would have listened to that. Mm-hmm. But they don't have reason.
I want to pick up on this point about the oil dependence on this pathway, the Strait of Hormuz, because the Strait, of course, handles a lot of the world's oil, maybe up to 20% of the world's oil. But that number is not that meaningful to me because, for instance, we don't get significant oil from there, maybe 2%. I don't know, 1 to 2% of our oil comes through there. And it leads to really the question that I have, which is, why is it that after all of these decades of obvious uniform opinion of the Western nations that Iran is a threat, that Iran is a terrorist nation, that Iran supports terrorism, that Iran is a religious theocracy that is really aiming on destruction of Western values and nations and people, and is a nuclear ambitious program, why these Western allies, especially the UK and France, have been so reluctant to provide meaningful support in this US-Iran conflict, because their goals have always been the same, I thought. And the question I have about the oil dependence is the data that shows that, and you mentioned, yes, China is the major customer of Iranian oil, almost 40% of their oil, and India, almost 15% from the numbers I dug up, and South Korea and Japan have significant, but the Western nations are not significantly dependent on Iran oil. The UK, I have here 5%, France, 6%. This is a small portion of their crude oil imports. The EU overall is about 6%. So why are they so reluctant, in your view, to get involved here? I understand there's a reason that they don't need as much oil through the straits. But of course, when you block the Strait of Hormuz, you're causing a chaotic problem in the economic oil market of the world, since China is a big time consumer. China, India, Korea, Japan, these are major consumers and need oil. So I would think that, and then the second part of my surprise at the Western European nations not being part of this is that, you know, the world has changed. We're seeing other Gulf nations be against Iran, at least in their behavior about the Strait of Hormuz and their nuclear ambition. And we're seeing the thirst, really, and recognition that economic development of these Gulf nations is good for their people. And so, you know, the whole new era, I think, that President Trump has brought into this peace seeking in the region is based upon economic development. So I want to go first to, why do countries like the UK and France not want to participate in something that they've spoken about as such a threat for so many years?
Again, that's a little beyond my area of expertise, but my guess is, from what I have read, is that they are unhappy that they weren't consulted about the attack to begin with. They think that they should have been informed, and they are essentially telling the president that you made this, now you solve it. But I think Iran, with its overreach, with its attempt to close the strait, with its attempt at Saudi Arabia and Qatar and United Arab Emirates, they have had more missiles and drones against United Arab Emirates than against Israel. They overplayed their hand and thus forced, I think, the Europeans to come back and say, well, maybe we will reluctantly come because you can't allow Iran to have this monopoly control over the Strait of Hormuz. And it isn't just, as you well know, it isn't just oil whose prices are changing, but other commodities are having price increases. Gas is having serious shortages in some parts of Europe because of the attack on, for example, Qatar, the attack on Pars that happened yesterday. President Trump has spoken very clearly that this shouldn't happen unless Iran makes another attack on Qatar. So I think that explains, I mean, that goes back to the tensions over NATO, over what they think is the unilateralism. But Iran's overreach and the consequences of that, what I think is overreach, as you say, to the Iranian regime, this is very rational. This is their mode for survival. But to me, it was a mode for survival indicating profound desperation. They went to DEFCON 4 at the first attack on the regime. It was a major attack. They took out the leaders and 40 of the top advisors who were incredibly, again, meeting in the same place. Indicating the chaos and indicating Israel's and the CIA, both of them claimed they knew where the meeting was taking place.
The intelligence is pretty astounding in terms of ours with Israeli and probably others. You know, I want to talk about the geography there a little bit, because I think it's fascinating. If you look at the map, The narrowest part of the Strait of Hormuz is about 20-21 miles, and right across the Iranian side, on the other side, is the UAE. And the UAE, to me, again, I'm not very knowledgeable about this, but the UAE is the opposite of Iran in so many ways.
Absolutely.
The UAE represents the most diversified economic powerhouse. It combines Western and the Middle Eastern sort of cultures. When you walk into Dubai, and now even more also like Abu Dhabi, but Dubai particularly, tourism, finance, you know, all the things that the West brings to the table, the restaurants there, the hotels, the medical centers. I mean, it's very, very uniquely a mix of Western and the Middle East. And so it's sort of... is it true, in my view, is yes, this is a brilliant part of the Trump administration's accomplishments, was the Abraham Accords, but changing the dynamic in the region to understanding that, you know, economic development and what it brings, including certainly freedom, although it may be more gradual, is the key to their own population's growth. And also, I think even Saudi Arabia has recognized for many years that they need to diversify from just oil. And what do you think of this, and sort of how is it that that this was never recognized before? Was it just that we didn't have our own leaders being able to understand this? Or is it just that something has changed in the Middle East?
I think it's a combination of both, but I think primarily it's changes in the Middle East. I think the rise of United Arab Emirates is truly remarkable. I was there a couple of times many, many years ago. And United Arab Emirates is what Iran could have been if Iran had wise leadership and even more powerful. because the United Arab Emirates has a very small population. Iran has 90 million. And it has 90 million very educated. And it has a geography and everything else. They and the people of Iran could, till recently, travel to United Arab Emirates. They saw images of United Arab Emirates. They were constantly reminded by satellite TV that when these guys took over, United Arab Emirates was almost non-existent. Look at what they have done for 40 years. And Iran, which is in natural resources richer than they are, in human resources is several times more than they are. Look what these idiots have done. And look at what that wise leadership has done. And since MBS came and essentially controlled the radical Wahhabis and said, go home. You can't dictate how people appear in the street. You can't tell the government, as the Wahhabis did, that you can't have a cinema in Saudi Arabia. He started having cinemas. He started having Jennifer Lopez do dances. He started having soccer teams that could absolutely outplay almost anybody else. So he created a new, I think, model. The Saudis were very important mm-hmm. in supporting some of the radical schools of Wahhabism throughout the world. That money has now been seriously curtailed. So there is a different model. And I think one of the fears of the Khamenei's of the world was and is that the Abrahamic Accord is the future. I think the Abrahamic Accord is, in a sense, the present. I think the only thing that is holding it up is the question of the Israelis accepting some form of a two-state solution. Otherwise, I think tomorrow MBS would sign. And particularly with the way the Iranian regime has behaved in all of this event, going after Saudi Arabia, going after United Arab, it has.
This is the overreach that you're talking about. That is a really seems that it should backfire and is probably already doing so.
Yeah,
is the education? You know, you talked a lot about the era of the Golden Age, and I think everybody knows that education was a huge focus and very successful in Iran in the previous era. What's been going on in the past 10, 20 years about education and even information access? You did mention that, okay, people see what's going on in the UAE and they say that could have been us. But was there really a lot of information access through satellite TV, or was it, you know, how do we assess that? And also the education of a generation of young people, is it that they were educated that the U.S. is still the great Satan, or is that sort of overstated in terms of the majority of people?
No, it isn't overstated in a sense that it is an essential, constant, ad nauseum part of the official discourse. But the official discourse is laughed at. The way people in the Soviet Union, for example, when the Soviets talked about racism in America and showed a picture of Louis Armstrong being, for example, bullied in the street, people in Soviet Union by 60s and 70s knew this is nonsense. Nobody believes the rhetoric of this regime. Nobody believes that this regime is capable of articulating the truth. Satellite TV was part of it, but Iran was very, till recently, Iran was extremely well connected. Something like Iran had 90 million, has 90 million populations. Before this, there were 150 million SIM cards. In other words, 150 million people were on internet, 150 million phones. Mm-hmm. There are enormous number of businesses on internet in Iran. Over 80% of the Iranian people use VPNs to bypass the regime censor and access information outside. And to give you a sense of the corruption of the regime and the complexity, VPNs are sold by the same IRGC that are censoring the internet. They censor the internet. It's Orwellian. They censor the internet and then they sell the VPNs for it.
Yeah. And in that sense, there's a lot of shared incompetence or bizarre lunacy of all governments, I hate to say, with my own cynical view. So let's just finish up with where you think this is going. Do you think that this, you know, two things. One is this so-called nuclear capability. You know, is the end game, I know the stated end game is to get rid of all, you know, military and nuclear capability. But there are other countries that have nuclear capability that we don't feel that way. I'll give you an example, North Korea. And why is that, I wonder? And in my view, it's because they're not sponsoring terrorism all over the world. They're not attacking U.S. They don't have cells of North Korean terrorists in Western nations. I think it's just very different. And so that's one part of the what's happening with that. And secondly, are we optimistic or practical in thinking that, yes, this is going to be the end of this regime and the Iranian people actually want the freedom that is being evidenced in their neighboring Gulf states? And in the end, this is going to have the good result that we hope for.
Yeah. You know, I have long believed that the Iran's nuclear program did not, in my view, have a military solution. There is nothing that this regime can promise, if it is in power, that will leave the rest of the world be at peace with the fact that they have any nuclear program, precisely for the characteristics that you said, precisely because it is its stated policy to destroy the state of Israel. Well, Israel is not going to stand by and right. allow you to develop a bomb. When you're at your weakest, it's going to attack you. When you say death to America and the destruction of America, the throwing out of United States from all bases in the Middle East is our goal. They just repeated it a few days ago in an Orwellian, again, overreach. They're not going to allow you. Israel was an ally of Iran in Iran's nuclear program under the Shah. The same Israel that is now going to war to destroy it was helping Iran, and not, same Iran, same geography, same people. Because they know if the Shah gets a bomb even, he ain't going to throw one at Israel. He ain't going to throw one at anybody. It's a deterrence for him. These guys, particularly the way they have behaved on this, they're willing to take the entire economy of the world hostage to stay in power.
To think yeah, that, as you mentioned, you use the word desperation, and I think that is true. The question is, what is the ultimate? You're confident, it sounds like, or certainly optimistic, that the Iranian people, they don't want this sort of hostility with Western civilization, you're confident that the Iranian people look at the models evolving in the UAE, even Saudi loosening up their ties, diversifying income, trying to get tourism going, you know, Qatar and the UAE putting intellectual property and innovation at front and center for their economic development. You see this as the likely outcome of this eventually.
Absolutely. I absolutely believe a secular democratic Iran is the only thing that the people want. It is the only way to solve the economic morass that this regime has created. And it's the only way to realize the potential. You talk about tourism. I don't know how many billions of dollars United Arab Emirates makes from tourism. But Turkey gets something like $40 billion from tourism. Iran is every inch of it as appealing for tourists. In terms of history, Iran has 12,000 years of recorded history on that plateau. 12,000.
the city of Gilgamesh, the city that is referred to as Gilgamesh, the oldest novel in the world, is in Iran. It's in Rafsanjan. Persepolis, 3,000 to 2,500 years. That's the last one, 10,000 years. There are cities in Iran that have the culture of Elam. Go to Louvre. Next time you go to Louvre, go to the antiquities, go to the part of Elam. It's a remarkable culture, 7,000 years ago. All of this is squandered in the hand of these imbeciles who hate modernity, who hate women, who hate anyone who's not like them, and have been given a jewel of a nation. Mm-hmm. And they have squandered it. And people know this. That's why they hate them and want to be rid of them.
Well, let's end on the optimistic note that the people in Iran are as eager for modernity to really elevate their own lives and their own country and restore Iran really to its historical glory, really, is the appropriate word.
Absolutely.
In a nation that can contribute to, you know, to civilization and to all the things that, that freedom brings.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure talking with you.
It was a great pleasure, Abbas. Thank you very much. And I hope to have you back as things hopefully are more positive.
I hope so.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Abbas Milani, follow his work at Hoover Institution and at Stanford University. And don't forget to subscribe to this show on YouTube, Spotify, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts today. And I'll see you next time.